From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack alongside Evan Dawson for your weekly wrap-up of Connections. Thank you so much for joining us, as always. We'll start this week's podcast with a conversation about America's greatness. Now, this might sound familiar to last week's podcast, and that's because it is. We've been having conversations with a range of people in our community about Governor Cuomo's comment that America, quote, was never that great, end quote. He later walked back those comments.
In this conversation, local activists expressed their frustration with him walking back the statement. They joined us for a conversation about if America is making progress in the fight for equal rights. In this clip, our guests discuss the best way to achieve their goals and the difference between agitation versus infiltration. You're going to hear some disagreement between activists Stephanie Vargas, Kristen Walker, Tanya Noel, and up first, Adrian Hale.
The reality is we've come a long way from where we were. And what I think is most important is instead of wasting so much energy simply trying to persuade people who have an essentially different perspective of America than each and every one of us, our energy will be much better met if we empower the people who are being marginalized and oppressed to understand that your rights, your humanity and dignity isn't contingent on anybody else's definition of you or anybody else's acceptance of you, but that you have to walk in that power. And you have to understand that now it's not just about being agitators, but in many ways we have to become infiltrators. We have to inform institutional practice and practice change. Because until the manufacturing of the problems is ended, we're always gonna only be addressing symptoms.
I think we need both. We need the agitators and the infiltrators. Not just one. There's more than one
both
way
in.
To skin a goat. You know what I mean? We need all of it.
But to her point, though, and most of this progress that we've had, and I will just say much of it is watered down compromise progress, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's
yes.
not
so
full
that's
freedom.
The point.
Yes.
It's not.
All
it's not.
A result of agitation. All a result of people not on the inside making decisions, not signing laws, not passing bills, not amending bills, but on the outside trying to convince someone who doesn't share your values why they should do the right thing versus becoming that person.
We have examples of people who are quote unquote infiltrators. Thurgood Marshall, I guess, was an infiltrator, right? Because he went into that system to say, I'm going to do something different to change it in the way that I can in the system. We have people infiltrating systems all the time, but I think if we're not tearing down the system,
right. When do we decide to
fail? We can't keep going because the system is inherently flawed. Like,
yes.
All of these systems.
So infiltration
are inherently
isn't the
flawed.
Same thing as just occupying a seat of positional authority. Mm-hmm. I just want to be clear with you on mm-hmm. that. Infiltration can only occur if a set of values and principles are held deeply and inherently in an individual, and then they're in a position where they can make those decisions or they can set the policy agenda. So let's just be clear. Occupying positional authority does not make you an infiltrator.
Okay, but back to policy. Policy has never saved us, and policy has never been the
That's
way
that
we've
That's not a true statement. The 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment.
That still lets us be slaves right now.
Right now. That's what our prison system is like if
right.
we go back to it. So that policy also doesn't help us either.
So hold
Force
up.
Manual labor.
But there's a difference between yeah,
Brown versus Board of Education. Also policies that were put in place by people trying mm-hmm. to help, which we see right now. We have more segregated mm-hmm. schools in 2018 in Rochester, New York mm-hmm. than we've ever had
before. Well, all across the country.
But I'm just talking about specifically to where we are. Where do the policies actually help us out?
But
where we need to be focused on policy. Like, we could focus on policy change, that's fine, but when has policy actually changed the conditions of people that we interact
so
with
you're
every
making,
day?
Yeah, so you're making my point. That is my point. Policy has always been shaped by folks who do not share our principles and our values, and we've had to compromise mm-hmm. on right for people who don't share them because there have always been agitators on the fringes from the outside saying, do the right thing, do the right thing. Even when you have mass action, and it only produces a watered down result that doesn't fully give folks what they need, not just what they want, right? As a black man, 250, 6'2", I need to be protected from police brutality. That's not just a want or a desire from me. And until you get folks who are willing to go to Albany to look at New York State Taylor Law protecting police officers, to look at city council, right now there's a police accountability board that we're trying to get through with a majority of minority council and a black mayor. Okay, so again, going back to my point of infiltration is not the same as occupying positional authority. When there are people in those positions who could give us much more substantive policy and law. Because guess what? At the end of the day, when a law or a policy is changed and the courts are the mechanism to which it must be upheld, that changes the whole game. It's the difference between me being beat by the police and nothing happening because the protections provided to the police officer versus now myself or my family having mechanisms in which to hold them accountable, even if they want to act in their own bias.
Or we could just abolish the police.
And that's the thing. We can't keep saying we're going to fix these systems or like these things are going to change. I think that
we've been reforming since the
Reconstruction. Since forever, we've been reforming. And it's just,
you can look at the history of the police department. How did it start off? They were chasing slaves to bring them back to their math. It's inherently a racist system.
They were using the military too. They're using the military too to do that.
Which is an inherently racist institution.
Capitalist is white supremacist.
It just is. All of these systems are. So I think that even saying that we need to continue to go into these systems to try to change, like maybe we need to build a new system. Maybe this just isn't working for us at all because we didn't have a say in this and it doesn't fit our actual ideas.
But this is too radical for a lot of people.
I think there's a difference between saying that a system is inherently flawed or the behavior of a system is inherently flawed because those who have administered the rights, the freedoms, and the privileges of those systems have done so in a biased and unjust way. Like, I think there's a very different conversation to be had.
Next, socialism is making a bit of a comeback in the United States. Polling shows that Americans under the age of 30 now have a negative view of capitalism and are more open to socialism than previous generations. In the weeks to come, we're going to welcome guests who defend capitalism on various grounds. This week, we heard from a pair of committed socialists who say that the financial collapse 10 years ago has convinced a generation of Americans to look for something else.
In this clip, you'll hear Lyle Rubin, co-founder of the Rochester chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, and Michelle Sapir, a member of the International Socialist Organization.
A lot of the capitalist apologists will say Norway and Denmark and Sweden, the reason they're so successful, because no one really denies now that Scandinavia really is the most successful region in the world when it comes to overall quality of life, when it comes to growth, when it comes to innovation, believe it or not, they're leading the world on pretty much any metric. So no one denies that anymore. So the capitalist apologists are saying, well, that's because in reality, Norway and Denmark, they're all capitalist economies. But if you actually look at the numbers, the majority of wealth in Norway is owned by the public sector. The overwhelming majority of the populace in Norway and Denmark and Sweden are unionized.
Are people demotivated to work?
Oh, not at all. I mean, they have a much healthier economy overall than the American economy and most other capitalist economies in Europe, in fact.
Are people demotivated to innovate?
No, they rank, if you go to the Bloomberg Index for innovation, they're at the top. Scandinavia has been at the top for years. So if you look at, just overall the democratization of capital, so you're talking about enough money to actually invest in companies, the majority of the capital in Norway, in Denmark, is owned by the public. It's a combination of worker-owned firms and state-owned enterprises. And then you also have what's called a sovereign wealth fund, which we actually have a sovereign wealth fund in the United States. It's in Alaska, and it works very well. A certain percentage of the profits from the oil company go to the people. And even in Texas, they have a similar setup where it goes to education. So these are socialist policies that work and that we should build on.
One would think that if you were in a room of all cynical branding experts, you might call it social capitalism, because what you're talking about is sort of spreading out capital and not concentrating it in the hands of a few.
I'm curious about Michelle's answer here, but I do want to say that you stop talking about capitalism once the majority of the capital is owned by the majority of the people.
Fair. Okay. Michelle, so all right. So, but how do you view the lessons of history in that way? For those who are scared of, not just concerned about socialism limiting individual rights, but scared about authoritarianism that seems often sort of coupled, at least in the popular minds of the critics, with that. What do you say to that kind of criticism?
Well, I'll piggyback on what Lyle was saying as far as the, socialism and socialist leaders were in the center of all the great civil and human rights that we have in this country, from the abolitionist movement to, you mentioned Eugene Debs in the beginning getting votes in 1912. He also got almost 1 million in 1918 from prison. where he was at for speaking out against World War I. You have Helen Keller, who was a socialist. We have the Disabilities Act, you know, due to that movement, C.L.R. James, et cetera. These people and these viewpoints have been at the center of all these historic moments. And when you had mentioned the rich capitalist walking down the street, my first thought was that rich capitalist wouldn't be on that street. And my second thought is they depend on that homeless person to remain a rich capitalist. It's that disproportion of wealth that they actually need to remain who they are today. As far as spreading capital, you know, the more that the means of production goes back to the workers, then you don't have that problem.
A transition to a bigger socialistic model in this country, do you want to do it in a sort of graduated step-by-step, sector-by-sector approach, or is this more of a wholesale achievable idea in the short or medium term? I'll start with Lyle.
Ideally, I would like it all to happen right now. I am one of those people that walks down the street and I'm absolutely disgusted by the poverty that I see. I just went running around Rochester this morning and I saw quite a lot of it. So I think what Martin Luther King called the urgency of now is very much something that leads my own kind of politics. With that said, I don't believe that we're going to be able to achieve, you know, my kind of socialist vision tomorrow. But I certainly think that having that fire in me to at least keep that as my goal makes it much more possible that we can achieve something near that down the line.
Let's end the week with a drink. How about a pumpkin spice latte? Well, this week, major brands like Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts brought back their pumpkin spice lattes, spawning dozens of new stories. It's a form of journalism called trend reporting. But critics say there's a problem. Trend reporting tends to reward and give free advertising to huge corporations that already have big advantages in the marketplace. Small businesses tend to get ignored, even if local coffee shops offer their own pumpkin spice lattes or PSLs.
We talked about it with Andrea Hickerson, director of the School of Communication at RIT. It's a conversation about journalism, standards, and the struggle to stay in business.
You think about it, there were more ads in papers before. And if we want to go back to the 1880s and talk about the penny press, I mean, they had patent medicines that weren't even true. And, you know, they were selling the ads there. So we have a history of hawking products in the news. So to act like it wasn't or that we weren't doing that before is unusual. And then, you know, something that was really important to me, an important experience I had, is when I was an intern at a small paper called the Daily Local News in Westchester, Pennsylvania. My features editor gave me a story to write, and it was about a construction company that was putting in new houses. And so I worked on it, you know, very hard, apply myself to this story. And it got published. And then the editor came to me. He said, "Oh, Andrea, you didn't have to work so hard on that story. We were doing that as a favor." And I was crushed.
As a favor?
Yes. Yeah. And I was crushed. I mean, I'm glad I didn't know that. But I don't know if he thought that I was savvier than that and didn't take it so seriously. But, you know, that wasn't that long ago. I mean, 15, 20 years ago. But, I'm just not sold on this idea that things are so much worse now or that they were so much better before.
What would you have said had you known it was a quote-unquote favor story?
I mean, I would have asked more questions about it. I mean, I was 19. I was still learning from people. So I don't know. You're pretty powerless in that position when the whole point is that it's experiential learning to do this type of assignment. But I would have asked more about it. And I think I was still really self-righteous at 19 and probably would have said why, you know, and was trained at a really good journalism school where I knew that that wasn't okay. And I still have that feeling like it was a very formative experience for me.
Yeah, I look now at, sometimes it's called advertorials or content that is paid advertising that will show up either in a newspaper or on an internet website. I saw a lot of it at least, I feel like 5-10 years ago on Slate. I don't know if it's on there as much anymore. I think probably it is. That looks, it's almost disguised like a newspaper piece. And it's often hard to tell. That I am way less comfortable with. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
I am too. I mean, I see that there is a place for sponsored content, but then you have to really look at the labeling and see if it's really obvious. Because I've definitely been reading magazines and there's an ad for like a Caribbean vacation and it feels like weird in the context of this magazine because the font hasn't even changed. I understand that that's a way to make money. I understand that companies pay for that type of thing. And I think that we have to acknowledge the realities of the industry. But we really have to put our consumers first or the audiences first and make sure that they're aware of what's going on. You know, what came off a press release? What is entrepreneurial reporting? We have to tell people.
Tracy Schumacher, who is a writer for the Democrat and Chronicle, and a good one, by the way, and a friend of this program, and someone I read all the time, She writes the following on Twitter. She says, I've been asked whether businesses pay for my Democrat and Chronicle food and drink coverage countless times. The answer is always no. But what I think is odd is people who don't subscribe or advertise suddenly being so interested in our profitability. Why are they so concerned with our giving away, quote, free advertising? Reporters are measured in part by the number of people reading their content. I am sure that story was written because people will read it. She's talking about the Starbucks story out of Chicago. She said, I have no plans to write about Starbucks lattes, but I'm sure it was written because people will read it. And there is, at least in part, a measurement of reporters based on content. And they do measure this. They can tell you how many times people click on your stories. And they can tell you how many times people sort of follow up and how long they're spending on this. So that's real. That doesn't mean, if we have Wade from Fifth Frame on, that this is a form of advertising. It doesn't mean that this is hardcore investigative journalism. And does it benefit Fifth Frame? I think anybody who comes on the program, generally speaking, unless they're really stepping in it, can benefit. But my job as the host of this program is not to get mired down in salesmanship. It's to have conversations that people care about. And if it makes people interested in your product or your business or your organization or your cause, so be it. We are talking about the pulse of the community. But let's talk about what Tracy said. So, Andrea, Tracy Schumacher is saying, number one, no, we're not selling news stories. Nobody can call Tracy Schumacher and say, hey, I'd love for you to review my restaurant. How much is that going to cost? That doesn't happen. But people, the fact that people think that's a pretty cynical thing.
It is.
And it's not good for journalism that people might think that.
No, and I think, you know, that's a part of the larger industry trend now, is that a lot of people have assumptions about journalism and the way that it works. And traditionally, journalists haven't wanted to engage with their audiences about how they get their stories and how that is made, and kind of have this voice that's kind of distant, which is fine. But then I think it's just related to a lot of misinformation about how these stories are made, that no, they're not paid, you know, that they don't, that they go there in secret sometimes if it's a food review or anything like that. So I agree with what she's saying completely, and I'm incredibly sympathetic to that. And the point too, that how many of these people are actually paying for the newspaper as well. So they're quick to criticize local, you know, local businesses not being patronized, but how many of them are actually paying for the Democrat and Chronicle?
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. Get those pumpkin spice lattes, and we will talk to you Monday.